At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Trade war status update on this Monday. It is on. Very, very on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, today the 17th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To those for whom the answer to the question, are we in a trade war yet, was, we got to wait and see, the White House this afternoon has made up your mind for you. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on the trade beat in our New York bureau. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
All right, big announcement this afternoon. Give us the skinny, would you?
Yeah, so the Trump administration has decided to move forward with an additional tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports. So already we have tariffs on about $50 billion of Chinese imports in place. This significantly increases the number of products that will be facing a tariff. So now about half the goods coming from China will have some additional tariff, and that's a significant expansion for sure. The tariffs will start at 10% until the end of the year, and then they'll jump to 25% starting in January.
What's on the list? What are the goods that's on this tariff list?
Yeah, so the first time around, the list was more targeted to try and avoid consumer products and specifically go after certain Chinese industries. Mm-hmm. Now, when you expand the list as significantly as the Trump administration is, consumer products just are naturally swept into that. So definitely stuff that we buy at Walmart or Target, things of that nature are on this list. But notably, the Trump administration removed about 300 tariff lines, products that it was considering putting tariffs on earlier this summer. So smartwatches and Bluetooth devices, for example, they'll be spared. Some consumer safety products like high chairs, car seats, playpens, bike helmets, they're also exempted.
What about Chinese retaliation? The Chinese have promised that they will not go gently into that good night, as it were.
Right. And we've seen in the past, as soon as the Trump administration has announced tariffs, they've announced tariffs of their own. They have likewise promised to retaliate against these tariffs. But part of this announcement, Trump said that if China does retaliate, he will immediately pursue what he called phase three, which is tariffs on approximately $267 billion of additional imports.
So to be clear, you do the math, you add up the $250 billion worth of goods that are being tariffed right now, or will soon be tariffed, right, end of the month, with the 267, that would be 100% of everything this country imports from China.
That would be everything we import from China, pretty much.
Coming through the holiday shopping season and Walmart store shelves and all of that, right?
Exactly. We heard earlier this summer that the list of proposed tariffs, which is now seemingly to go through, was canoes and carpet and toilet paper and baseball mitts, all sorts of consumer goods.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson on the trade beat from our bureau in New York on the news today of those new $200 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese goods. Tracy, thanks a lot.
Anytime.
As we were saying, that list of $200 billion worth of Chinese imports that the White House wants to put new tariffs on is basically half of everything the United States buys from that country. And those tariffs are coming despite hundreds of people testifying against them to the U.S. Trade Representative a couple of weeks ago. Julie Hughes was one of those people. She's the president of the U.S. Fashion Industry Association. We talked to her back then, and we got her on the phone again today to talk things over. Good to have you back, Julie.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to join you.
So we had you on in August, which somehow seems a very long time ago, as you were testifying before the USTR. What do you make of the latest developments in this whole tariff situation?
Gosh, you know, we're pretty concerned, you know, just for consumer products. I mean, it's hats, it's handbags, it's furniture, it's lighting, it's gloves. There's a lot of products that are on this list that consumers buy and use every day.
Your members, though, have obviously their bottom lines on the line, as it were. How long do you suppose they will be able to protect consumers from the effect of these tariffs?
You know, in terms of what the pricing is going to be in the short term, most products obviously are covered by contracts. And so the price that the retailer or brand is able to pay is that's already fixed. So, you know, we're probably not going to see prices go up immediately, but we will start to see them going up over time. Some of it depends on, so what's the implementation? You know, there still are a lot of uncertainties.
Do you have a plan B? I mean, we talked last time about how dependent a lot of your member companies are on China. Could you go to Mexico or elsewhere in Asia?
You know, absolutely, there are other places that companies can source. The problem is that there's no place that every company can go source. Huh. So, you know, there aren't a lot of places that can replace China.
All right. So here comes the $64,000 question. Do you think these tariffs are going to work? Is the president going to get what he wants?
Well, no. I mean, that's the most concerning part of all of this. And, you know, we've tried to be really thoughtful in our testimony and in our comments to the administration. We get it. There are serious issues in the trading relationship between the U.S. and China, particularly for intellectual property and the technology transfer issues. But I still don't see that what's going to actually get a solution and get a positive outcome are the tariffs. I mean, the tariffs maybe feel good. It's a unilateral decision. The problem is, how do we get them off and how do we get to a conclusion without somebody having to say they back down or some kind of, you know, trade war that goes on for a long time.
Julie Hughes, president of the U.S. Fashion Industry Association. Julie, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Wall Street on this Monday took the tariff news pretty much in stride. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I heard a saying today I had never heard before, but it totally fits this next story. There is nothing new money likes better than old money, which will make sense once I tell you that the topic of conversation was Marc Benioff, one of the founders of the cloud services company Salesforce, and his wife Lynn, buying Time magazine for $190 million. The Benioffs aren't the first tech billionaires to use their money to invest in old-line media companies. Think Jeff Bezos in the Washington Post, Lorene Powell Jobs, widow of Steve, and her stake in The Atlantic. The Benioffs say they are not going to be involved in day-to-day operations or editorial decisions, but as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, the deal could buy the historic magazine more time to find its place in the digital age.
News of the Time sale was particularly good news for Sameer Husni. 9 years ago, he founded the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi when he says everyone was predicting the death of print. Just around the time Newsweek was sold for a dollar.
The funny thing is, like, now we are hearing that print is the new media.
After years of declining circulation and ad revenue, Time, the magazine, still has more than 2 million subscribers. It's also grown its digital audience by investing in video. Husni says to survive, Time has to move beyond being a newsweekly.
Time magazine has to become more like a monthly on a weekly basis. In-depth reporting, great printing quality, great paper, while spreading their wings through all the digital platforms that are out there.
If that sounds expensive, that's why it helps to have billionaire backers. Susan Curry Sivak teaches journalism and media studies at Linfield College in Oregon.
I think it's really interesting that Benioff in his tweet about this used the term stewards, that they wanted to be stewards of the Time product and brand.
That kind of philosophy can give newsrooms the freedom to innovate and take risks, as she says has happened with the Washington Post under Jeff Bezos. Rick Edmonds is media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. He says that doesn't always work, though.
While the billionaire owner is very helpful, doesn't ensure success.
He says Red Sox owner John Henry has expressed frustration that his investment in the Boston Globe has been slow to pay off. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Beth Comstock spent 27 years working for General Electric in one capacity or another at one subsidiary or another, leaving at the end of last year as the company's vice chair running a group called GE Business Innovations. Her thoughts on her career and what it takes to thrive in a constantly changing workplace are in a new book called Imagine It Forward. Beth, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So let's get this out of the way first of all. Why'd you leave GE? Was it just time?
Well, it was time, but I left sooner than I imagined I would. We had a leadership change, and you know how that goes. New boss, new team, and the old team's got to go.
she says rather bluntly, that's, you know, when you got to go, you got to go, I guess, right?
Yeah, I've thought a lot this year about knowing when to exit and how you think about that, because I think I'm all about change, and I think knowing your exit is also something you have to think about.
Well, so that's really interesting that you bring that up, because the topic of this book of change and creativity and all of that, you say yourself in this book that despite all the success you had in your career, I mean, vice chair of GE for crying out loud, you are not a typical change agent.
I'm not. I come to this as an introvert, a reserved person. I hold back. I have an example where I worked in CNN and for Ted Turner for a year before he knew my name. And so I'm just not the one that put the ideas out there. And I had to really work to overcome my natural reserve and also some confidence along the way.
Give me a case study, would you? And let me put the caveat on the answer here. You can't pick one of the big innovative companies that we all know and love, like Facebook or Amazon or Apple, right? Who do you like out there? Who's doing change and innovation right?
I've been really intrigued by what I see Walmart doing right now.
Really?
Digital onslaught comes. What do they have? 1 million employees? I mean, the scale and complexity.
Yeah,
they buy Jet. They realize they have to go digital. What I like about their story is they recognized, I think maybe late, but they've recognized it, that they have to work with their strengths. What are their strengths? One, they have a lot of employees. Two, they have physical locations. So they've been investing more in having people pick up their packages on their way home from work. It's hard to change from within when you're a legacy company.
Well, let me poke you in the eye a little bit, right, and talk about GE, because GE is maybe the granddaddy of legacy companies in this economy, right?
Yep.
And it has, I won't say fallen on hard times lately, but it's been undergoing substantial change, not always successfully. It's not even in the Dow Industrials anymore. I mean, it's a legacy company that is still trying to make the turn.
Yeah, and I mean, GE has fallen out of grace, certainly from the public perception of late. It's a great company, and I was so proud to work there. I wish people could separate the stock from the company, but it's also a public company, and so I realize even saying that maybe sound a bit naive.
No, it's fair.
But I think people, especially with established companies, I think we underestimate the complexity that happens with scale. The need to keep the core machine running and innovate in the new, and it just creates a lot of tension and complexity, and cleaning that up is really hard. And I think we hold our legacy companies to a different standard just because we expect it to be easier, and it's not.
So let me ask you actually about taking a risk, and again, an anecdote in the book. Steve Jobs called and said, "Hey, come work for me." In point of fact, he called twice, right?
Yeah.
And you said no.
Yeah.
Do you look back at that and go,
you need
oh,
a big
man.
Pregnant pause after that, right?
You know, right? It kind of hangs there. I mean, granted, this was before Apple became, you know, what it is today, but it wasn't all that long ago.
Yeah. And I'll give you just a little bit of context that I was at NBC at that time in a really miserable assignment.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of reasons to want to leave there. And my gut was this wasn't the right job for me. I also think I was a bit afraid, and I probably didn't have the confidence even then that I could make it there. And so it's one of those things that, I'll be honest, I did regret it at times, especially when their stock price went up, and I'd be like, what was that? I remember my husband and I sitting down, and we're like, how good could that stock ever be?
Yeah, right.
But I think I just regretted an opportunity maybe to push myself in a new way. But I did it for good reasons, too. I was incredibly loyal to the path I was on, and the GE gave me lots of opportunities to grow and be innovative. So I had reasons to also know I could forge a different path where I was, too.
Beth Comstock used to be at GE for a very long time. Now she writes books. This one is called Imagine It Forward. Beth, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai. Nice talking to you. Thank you.
Coming up.
Heads and tips are cut off over here, and as we move down the line, they get cut into plates and moved into a milling process.
Aluminum sounds pretty rough, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 92 points today, 0.3%, 26,062 for the blue chips. NASDAQ gave back 114 points, 1.4%, 78.95. S&P 500 dipped 16 points, 0.5%, 28.88. Apple and Amazon investors took some profits today. Apple down 2.6%, Amazon down 3.1%. A lot of people are going to be coping with damaged and destroyed houses as floodwaters from Florence keep on rising. You'd think maybe insurance companies would be worried. So far, not so much. Allstate rose 0.3%, Progressive up 0.4%, Chubb up 0.1%. Today, over time, though, big sellers of plywood, generators, and other storm-fighting essentials usually do see some big impacts from natural disasters. Home Depot down 0.3% today. Lowe's slid just 0.1%. Bonds were flat. You're listening to Marketplace. Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The restaurant business is competitive. Margins are tight. Consumers can be fickle. So restaurateurs got to find their niche. The food business niche of interest to us today, or niche if you like, is what's known as fast casual, which in turn gets us to Tender Greens, a chain based here in Los Angeles, but looking to grow. Danielle Bruno is the CEO, and we met her at the Tender Greens at the corner of 6th and Olive in downtown L.A. It's an open kitchen kind of setup, deli-like in a way, just starting to get busy at 11 in the morning or so on the day that we were there.
So let's do a little walk and talk here while I ask you about the category, right?
Okay.
Fast casual, which means what in a business sense?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of define ourselves more as fine casual.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, these categories are really more...
So there's a division already, right? Fast cash to fine cash?
That's right, that's right. I mean, these are really internal terms.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what the consumer experiences is a restaurant that serves five-star quality food. I mean, we have classically trained chefs in every single one of our locations, but we serve it at a price of a typical fast casual because we've eliminated the white tablecloth, we don't have servers, and so we can keep those prices down while still focusing on the quality of the food and the talent of the chef.
All right, so let me have a quick look at the menu here, and we'll see what's what. So the chef special today is the Italian. What's that?
That's an Italian cold cut sandwich. It's
$14.50. That's not bad.
It's right. The best version of an Italian sandwich you've ever had.
This is not entirely germane, but casual is intentional here. And I will just point out that you're wearing blue jeans and a set of zip-up sneakers, and you're not, you know, you're like a hanging around CEO.
Yeah, I'm not a corporate-y sort of suit type.
You come from retail. Like retail proper.
I do, yeah.
What brought you to this company?
I don't really see retail or service as restaurants as that different from one another. For me, it's really the focus is on the consumer. And the consumer for all of those businesses are really similar. So the same woman who would get a blowout would probably eat at Tender Greens and drink Pete's coffee and buy an Apple computer.
Hmm. Okay, so to the company. You want to grow it. That's kind of why you're here.
I do.
Tell me about it. You got what, 30-ish stores now?
We have 28 locations, and we're going to double in size in the next couple of years.
That's ambitious.
It's not that ambitious.
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
Because Tender Greens has such a loyal audience. We are really popular amongst certain consumers that exist all around the country. I mean, the demographics here exist in the markets we're going to, New York, Boston. We have lots of places we can go. We have a really strong team who's done this many times.
But with that expansion comes, you got to keep the quality up.
Yep.
You have to keep the local sourcing up, right? Because
yep.
buying stuff for a store in downtown LA is not the same as buying stuff for a store
yep.
outside of Atlanta.
Yep.
You know?
It's not easy to do. In terms of keeping up the quality, that's probably the biggest challenge for any brand that has a strong culture and a strong brand to actually grow and maintain what's made us special. But I specifically hire people who have done that before and know how to do it.
What keeps you up at night? this is good.
Well, yeah,
sharp intake of breath, followed by a pause.
Yeah, what keeps me up at night is... it's not necessarily a problem. It's certainly good for the economy, but the unemployment rate is low.
And so labor for you.
Labor is tough. I mean, a lot of people are competing for the same talent right now. Unemployment's low, labor costs are high, and many of us are fighting for the same people.
So you know how you could get more people, right?
How?
Pay them more.
We do pay them more.
A lot more?
Yeah, in most positions we pay a lot more. And certainly our executive chefs are extremely competitive versus a fine dining environment where they have to deal with some hours and intensity
right.
and the culture of that environment.
Right.
But we're growing. Yeah. We need to find more people.
The CEO of Delta said to me once, if you're not growing your business, you're in slow motion liquidation.
Yeah, well, and especially in the current economy.
How are you feeling about the economy?
I'm feeling great about the economy. I think it's an interesting time for retail. It's an interesting time for restaurants, but I think it's going to be, you know, survival of the fittest. And I think that's a good thing.
Danielle, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Didn't wind up getting that Italian cold cut, by the by. I'm not a big lunch guy, but we did ask Danielle as a retail professional about the retail spaces she finds the most inspirational. It's actually a pretty interesting list, and we've got it at marketplace.org. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said today he is not in the mood to negotiate over his country's dairy tariffs. Those taxes are one of a couple of big sticking points left in the NAFTA renegotiations. But not in those talks, the American tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum that have been in place since June. Remember, it's 25% on steel coming into this country, 10% on aluminum. Almost half of Canada's aluminum comes from northern Quebec, a place actually called Aluminum Valley. Emma Jacobs took a trip.
Drive 2 hours north from Quebec City and you see rolling wooded hills and farmland that draw outdoorsy tourists. But you'll also see industrial parks and hydroelectric lines converging on a series of aluminum smelters along a 50-mile stretch of the Saguenay River. The first opened in 1926, and the buildings are still part of what is now called the Jonquière Complex. Alain Gagnon's family has a long history at the plant, like many in the area. He says his father, uncles, generations of relatives have worked in the Jonquière plant. He started as a machine operator in 1983 and is now president of the Aluminum Workers Union. The situation with Mr. Trump has recently brought uncertainty to the region, he says. Last year, the Aluminum Valley smelters produced 1.2 million tons of primary aluminum, with 80% for export to the United States. The company that owns them, Rio Tinto, employs about 4,000 people, and the tariffs so far have not led to any layoffs. But Gagnon says past experience makes many workers nervous. The big industry here, besides aluminum, used to be logging, but it was devastated by decades of U.S. protectionist measures. Now, Gagnon says people stop him everywhere he goes to ask,
Est-ce qu'on va revivre le bois d'œuvre?
Are we about to relive what happened with lumber with the aluminum? The answer is probably no in the short term, says Jean Simard. president of the trade group, the Aluminum Association of Canada. He says U.S. manufacturers depend on imported aluminum. Canada is their number one supplier.
They've developed a world-class downstream industry with 160,000 jobs processing it to make cars, planes, building and construction components.
Right now, Rio Tinto says customers in the U.S. are paying the cost of the tariffs. But smaller businesses in the Saguenay area don't have that leverage. Some, like PCP Aluminum, take the smelted metal and process it before exporting.
So we buy full raw ingots, full-size slabs from Rio Tinto.
Simon Holsgrove oversees sales at PCP Aluminum. About 50 employees cut those giant slabs into forms manufacturers can use.
Heads and tips are cut off over here, and as we move down the line, they get cut into plates and moved into a milling process.
But it's a process that aluminum working businesses in the U.S. can do too, says PCP's president, Michel Lavoie.
We have many competitors in the U.S. That's why I can push 10% more to my customer and think that we will be competitive with that.
Most of PCP's clients are in the United States. Lavoie's biggest hope, like for many in this region, is that Canada negotiates an end to the aluminum duties. In Saguenay, Quebec, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, you got Coke, you got Diet Coke, you got Coke Zero, and now possibly you're going to have Coke CBD. I'm not sure on the branding there exactly, but the underlying story is this. Coke says it's interested in making drinks containing CBD, the non-psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. It treats pain, but apparently doesn't get you high. Said the company, we are closely watching the growth of non-psychoactive CBD as an ingredient in functional wellness beverages around the world. Dude. All right, that's all we got. Dow Industrial's down 92 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ gave back 114, 1.4%. S&P 500 lost 16 points, about 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Underman. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.